Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another day here at The Damage Report. I'm John Adarola. We are still under lockdown and curfew. I don't know what comes next. Are we going to get grounded? I don't know. But we ain't going nowhere, so we might as well talk about the news. How's it going, Emma Vigeland? How are you doing?
I mean, it's going. I still have a pulse, theoretically, so we should be okay.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what I feel today? Proud to be an American. What a country we have. What a government we have.
I feel proud of being an American in terms of some of my fellow countrymen
totally.
And women.
That is true.
The rest of it's kind of terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. We're gonna talk about all of this, but just really fast. Like, and I know a million people have pointed this out, but the speed and coordination and resources, how quickly they've been rallied against protesters and couldn't be against the pandemic. Like, the convention center is a military base right now, but it took them so long to start to get swabs out to people. We can make gas masks, but not N95s. Why don't we give the nurses the gas masks if they've been like piling up in police departments around the country?
No, anyway. Gas masks are necessary to filter out the blood smell, because that only happens for cops. They're the only one that need to just be emotionally removed from the pain they're inflicting upon people, as opposed to protected when they're helping people.
Yeah. Well, look, everyone, thank you for joining us in the chat. It's great to have you here. Please hit the like button and share the stream if you haven't already, so that more people know that the stream is live and can come and join us and talk, hopefully, productively. I'm going to pop out this chat here so that I can follow it as we're talking along. We're obviously going to be talking about what happened in DC last night, but beyond that, we also have the results of the second independent George Floyd autopsy. We've got a little bit of an analysis of the actual looting that's been going on in the country over the past decade or so. And let's see. Oh, more on Antifa. That should be fun. Also, Joe Biden. What's he got to say? Some good, some Joe Biden. So we're going to have a little bit of that for you, too. So it should be a lot of fun. Chubtoad just said, I have a call at 10:30. Please pause for 30 minutes. Chubtoad, just because it's you, we will pause. We will sit here silently, and then we'll come back.
And because you said please.
He did say please. That is nice. Okay, with that, why don't we jump into the news, Emma Vigeland? What do you think?
Let's do it.
Last night, Donald Trump finally spoke. And seconds into it, I wish he would go back into the bunker. But here's a little bit of what he said last night.
I swore an oath to uphold the laws of our nation, and that is exactly what I will do. I will fight to protect you. I am your president of law and order and an ally of all peaceful protesters.
And then there was like a rib shot afterward. Of course, the joke is on us, of course, because it's regular American people who are being brutalized, not Donald Trump and the elites that he was elected to represent, or at least installed to represent. Okay, so Emma, he's an ally of peaceful protesters. He said, I've upholded the law and followed it. Seems like there's a few issues with some of that.
Dude, you were literally impeached. Yeah, for breaking the law. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's terrifying. And I think the law and order shtick is not going to work this time around. I think people are devastated across the aisle, across the board. Even the suburban mom in Kansas who voted for Donald Trump in 2016, the specific people that Joe Biden is trying to target to win in the fall. I don't think that they're looking at these protests as unjustified or as reckless. There might be some pearl clutching about the rioting, the looting, et cetera, not fully understanding that that's an expression of pain. But I think when it comes to action following Floyd's murder, I don't see this tactic being favorable to Trump. I just can't imagine that it will, because I think the outrage is so widespread.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. You know, based on what I'm seeing in the numbers over the past few days, things have swung even more towards Joe Biden. I mean, again, it's a billion years until the election. Who knows? And Joe Biden has more than enough opportunity to look bad himself. But this doesn't seem to be helping him. I hope that while this is probably the best thing Trump could do to rile up his base isn't necessarily large enough to get him reelected. So we'll have to see about that. In the speech, Some things that I found incredibly frustrating, but not at all surprising. One, in a speech that was designed to respond to organization of people exercising their First Amendment rights, he didn't talk about the First Amendment. He skipped over and started talking about the Second Amendment with a reference that both made no sense in context and also made a little bit of sense. We understand why he threw out a comment about the Second Amendment. Because again, the message always has to be sent to his murderous followers. Hey, if you know have a gun, you know, you might have to defend yourself, maybe shoot some people. And of course, that is the sort of action that led us to where we are now.
Yeah, that part was also terrifying. I mean, he's advocating for actions that are beyond the legal scope of the presidency. So he's saying that he's going to force states to accept a troop presence in order to quell protests, which are one of the core pillars of the First Amendment, because there were a select few people that have been rioting and looting and breaking the law. The state governors have to ask for United States troops to enter their state for him to invoke the Insurrection Act. And it is illegal to use military forces as police on protesters on United States citizens. So what he's touting there, there's no legality behind it. But unfortunately, he has a lackey in the Justice Department in Bill Barr who will find any legal justification and twist whatever laws that he needs to in order to make Donald Trump happy. So this could be bluster, but it could be not. And if it's not, he has someone in the Justice Department who will institute whatever he feels Trump wants to do.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, we're going to talk more about the whole Antifa thing that they're pushing. But also, the overarching message from last night was there is domestic terrorism going on, and so I might have to dispatch the military everywhere, whether the states want it or not. The thing is, overwhelmingly, there is no domestic terrorism going on. There is protest going on. I hate how much Fox is willing to continue to push the narrative that it's all domestic terrorism. And to the extent that there are terrorist incidents, we've seen them. If you are driving a tanker truck and you decide to try to run down protesters, that's an ISIS attack right there, effectively. The names are different, I guess, but that's what they do. But that's not what Trump is talking about. He's not talking about trying to stop that sort of thing. He's trying to get the people out of the protests in the first place. And we actually saw that last night as well. So we had a speech, which we can talk more about. But we also had, while that was going on, and before, again, before the curfew was in effect, he decided they needed to clear people out of the area. And so, again, this is reporting from D.C. Garrett Hawk is going to tell you what happened last night.
I want to be super clear about what did and didn't happen right there. Nothing happened on the side that the protesters were in. I was standing with those protesters. I've been with them since 2 o'clock this afternoon. It was by far the most peaceful day of protest that we've had in DC since this started on Friday night. But before the curfew was into effect, we had mounted federal police coming down H Street from east to west, clearing people out of the street. In front of them, they were using flashbangs, tear gas. I lost my regular mask and had to replace it with my gas mask. That's what I experienced. That's what the tape shows. That's what history is going to show for tonight. And I'm a little shook by the whole thing, to be completely honest with you. It was absolutely extraordinary thing to see and experience with the White House in my peripheral vision.
We're going to have a little bit of the actual footage of people being cleared out in a second, but I also want to show you what happened not long after when they decided to, in an incredibly dangerous fashion, have helicopters, you can see, begin flying low below the level of the buildings to try to scare the protesters away, a tactic that apparently has been used by the U.S. military in theaters around the world. That's D.C. right near the White House. Those are people who are peacefully organizing. And they're treating them like insurgents in Fallujah.
Yeah, and every reporter on the scene, every single reporter, I read a long piece in the Washington Post today, says it was incredibly peaceful. People were dancing and singing to a woman playing guitar. And because maybe they looked like hippies and they wanted to have some sort of throwback to the atrocities committed by the police back in the day, they decided to go after them. I mean, it is to see a mainstream media reporter that shaken up, they are trained repeatedly to see both sides, to be fair, and to the detriment often of progressives and the truth. But that goes to show how unjustified and one-sided this action by DC police was on these protesters, all for a narcissistic BS photo op by a president who literally has no idea what he's doing and is so in over his depth.
Exactly. And she had a guitar.
A deadly weapon, probably.
Exactly.
If she really rocked out, she could break it like Kurt Cobain style, and then the shards of wood would be very scary for those fascist cops. I mean, just police.
She could shred a riff so sharp. Did you see that scene in Mad Max Fury Road? Guitar playing can be quite scary. No, but seriously, I think that it's important. So in the wake of last night where he... once again talks about dominating the streets, overwhelming force, says he's going to send the military around the country to take out the terrorists, which are just people who are rightfully enraged about what they see. And they tear gas peaceful protesters before the curfew and have horses trample them out of the region. And then they're buzzing the streets of D.C. with a helicopter. I believe it's important to acknowledge when you've been wrong about something. I believe it is not a show of weakness. It is a show of strength when you can acknowledge that. So I would like to take this opportunity to apologize for the many times over the past 3 or so years where I have implied that Donald Trump is a significant threat to this country. It was hyperbolic. It was hysteric. I don't know why I was exaggerating in that way. Obviously, he turned out to be the incredibly reasonable politician some surmised he might become.
I was wondering where you were going with that.
That's where I'm going. By the time Emma's back on the street, God only knows what he'll have ordered soldiers to do. And hopefully they'll turn down illegal orders. But if they're going to, I guarantee he told them to fly the helicopters like that. This dude has had a hard on for seeing tanks in the streets. Those are coming next. He's going to order them to kill protesters. And I only hope. We should never be put in a position where we have to hope that soldiers refuse orders from their superior officers. But this is obviously what Donald Trump wants done. He was, like, decades ago talking about how the show of strength of the Chinese regime in crushing the protests in Tiananmen Square. He has been building towards this his entire life. By the time Emma's on next, we could have protesters' bodies piling up in the streets. I hope that it doesn't come to that. But have you seen anything over the past 3 days that lead you to believe that that's not where we're going? We already had dozens of protesters nearly dead because of that madman with his tanker truck. We've got people wielding machetes and bows and arrows in the streets. We've got gangs of people being deputized by the police to walk around neighborhoods with baseball bats looking to pick fights with people. No, we were being hysterical. We were being ridiculous for years and implying that this was obviously where we were going.
John, you're missing the point. Because Donald Trump got elected, the progressive movement's actually stronger, and it galvanized so that we would all fight Donald Trump and that we'd have a new Speaker of the House. Oh, wait, we'd have someone in the Senate who was actually fighting for people in leadership, or for progressives in leadership. Oh, wait, and Joe Biden's the nominee. Well, just look, kidding.
Hopefully,
that terrible theory by idiots online that Trump would be better than Hillary Clinton for progressives has been proven so wrong. Mm-hmm. Look at what's going on right now. Look at the blood that's on your hands if you make that kind of argument. You can't make politics like a political... You can't go get behind political theories like you're some sort of sociopath Machiavellian guy who... Whatever,
sitting on the sidelines and talking about a country that you don't inhabit.
There's tangible realities of politics and people get hurt.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I actually there was referring more to the people who spent the last few years implying that any criticism or check on Trump is unnecessary. Why are you focusing on him? Stop pretending he's important. He is important because he's incredibly dangerous.
That Venn diagram for people on the left is a circle, John.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called The Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFDR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFDR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFDR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Donald Trump didn't just tear gas peaceful protesters and throw flashbangs into them, have his soldiers do that for nothing. He did it with a purpose, and that was for him to walk across the street and do a photo op in front of a church. Let's show you a bit of that. Is that your Bible?
It's a Raymore and Flanagan gift card, yeah, that I got for my birthday, so I could get a new bed frame that I haven't used yet.
They are cough drops. Do I look religious now?
Now the right wing. Do you want to buy an end table? I don't know what I'm doing.
Raymore and Flanagan. As I tweeted, I am an atheist. I have not read the entirety of the Bible, although I've probably read more than a good number of Christians. But I assume that if you were to study the Bible carefully, Old or New Testament, they would probably have something to say about brutalizing innocent people so that you can pretend to be Christian. That seems like something that if there were an Antichrist, which there isn't, maybe he's
Jew. Are you sure it's not Trump?
I mean, I don't think it exists. I think the entire thing is made up. But if it existed, that seems like something he'd probably do. I don't know. Especially when you find out, as we did, that, Jack Jenkins, reporter, spoke with Bishop Marion Budd of the Washington Diocese on Trump's remarks, quote, "Everything he has said is antithetical to the teachings of our traditions and what we stand for as a church. Also, one of those driven out with tear gas for the photo op was a priest of the diocese. She read me a message sent to her by the priest who was offering hospitality to the protesters, quote, I was literally coughing because of tear gas while helping people, and the police drove us off with riot gear and horses so that man could stand in front of our church with a Bible. They weren't even told he was coming to do that. He just decided, no, I'm going to go stand in front of that church. And they tear gassed a priest so he could pretend to be religious.
That's the Christian thing to do, is using chemical weapons against religious leaders. I think Jesus said that, don't you think?
There was probably something about that.
Also, I hear all the time, we have to invade other countries because they use chemical weapons on their citizens, and Donald Trump is doing it so he can take a photo in front of a church with a Bible he doesn't even read. There's a viral video from 2016 where he can't name one passage. They just want to name one of his favorite passages. It's so easy. I can remember John 3:16. Just say that. Just say that. I don't even believe in God either. And I know that one off the top of my head. Every little white girl has it tattooed on her... But I don't know. Just say that one. What do you call it? Tramp stamp.
I didn't know that was a trend. Yeah, it's easy. You know what's easy? Naming one newspaper you read or one Bible verse you follow. If you can't do either of those two things, you should be too stupid to be a right-wing con artist. But we've barely avoided the first, and we ended up with the latter. So
yeah, I cannot believe that you're making me think about Sarah Palin right now.
I know, that's true. Yeah, and look, so I'm doing my thing right now where things are so dark that I can't help but smile, the defense mechanism that I have. But they set a curfew, and then purposefully drove people out before they would have even theoretically have left for the curfew, so that Donald Trump could walk hulkingly across the street to stand in the most awkward way possible with a book, which is, it's how you'd hold, if you were forced to hold a dog turd, that's how you do it. You can see right there. What a weird...
I don't know. It was so weird.
Such an embarrassment around the whole world. Donald Trump's photo op yesterday where they brutalized a bunch of people so that he could pretend to be a Christian. That is embarrassing. What's theoretically more embarrassing is the lining up of the bootlickers to pretend that it wasn't what it was, and that it was, in fact, brave and strong and alpha of him to have done that. So Marco Rubio says, many in the media fell for the calculated and deliberate tactics of professional agitators. They knew the street needed to be cleared before 7 p.m. curfew, but they deliberately stayed to trigger police action and get the story they wanted that, quote, police attacked peaceful protesters. So that's not true. That's nonsense. But even if it wasn't nonsense, you're saying that because they were doing a little tactic, they're worse than the people who are throwing flashbangs and tear gas and running horses through them and all of that. That's Marco Rubio, a guy who briefly stuck his head up to pretend that he was in a stand against Donald Trump on the debate stage years ago. And now look at what he is forced to defend.
Little Marco, little brain, little man, little in every capacity. Only little, small people stand up for people, for authorities that have infinitely more power than just regular citizens who are unarmed. That means that you're small. That means that you're not brave enough to actually look at the facts on the ground and stand up for citizens, which is, I think, what you're elected to do, by the way. And it's easier, it's more comforting to side with the favorite than going with the underdog. It's the evil empire. Cool, Marco Rubio. Just goes to show that, as Trump aptly said, you're little, but not just in your stature. You're little as a person.
Yeah. Well, you're right. He is not brave, but we do know one person who is. We have been informed of such by Scott Walker, who said, hard to imagine any other POTUS having the guts to walk out of the White House like this. What?
Like what?
The F.
I hate he that black and white photo too.
Yeah, the black and white.
It's like the Entourage. It's like the Entourage cover, except it's just even more douchey, which I didn't think was possible.
So they sent in hundreds of military police to clear everyone out of the region, so that no one is nearby. No one's within earshot. And then he comes clomping out of the White House. What is brave about that? Seriously, you know how- Scott Walker, what is brave about that? And if you think that's brave, are you scared to stand near an open window? Or are you scared of what are you scared of that this looks like bravery to a tiny little wussy boy like you? Seriously. It's not bravery to brutalize people, to have other people brutalize people, and then for you to, like, walk out in their stead. That's not brave in any way.
You know how in A Song of Ice and Fire and the Game of Thrones book series, they're always talking about how Tyrion has to waddle and his short legs are, like, stunted and awkward? That's how I'm picturing Donald Trump right now in prose.
Yeah, and the thing is, too, like... Where's the thing? Okay, so my former co-host of True North referred to Trump as a scaredy puss online. She's from the UK, and I think that is absolutely perfect. Because Donald Trump, of course, wouldn't go out and meet with the protesters. He's too scared of that. He cleared them out before he even spoke far away. That's how scared he is. But he's not just scared of everything going on around him. That's why, after all, he was in the bunker. So he's that form of scared, but he's also terrified of what people think, which is why... this was reported. CNN reported that Trump was upset about media coverage portraying him as having hidden in a bunker during protests on Friday. His walk to the church was apparently meant to combat that narrative. So he's also terrified of looking weak. Not terrified enough to stop being weak, but terrified enough to attack people to pretend that he's not. Knowing that the layers of bootlickers around him will pretend that he's brave. That he's a brave boy who walked outside to a church and stood holding a Bible like he'd literally never clutched a book before in his life.
And he probably hadn't, John.
He probably hasn't. And it's not just Rubio and, you know, and Walker. They're Republican politicians. It's also state media. So as Trump walked through the recently tear-gassed Lafayette Park, Fox anchor Martha McCollum compared him to President Abraham Lincoln, remarking that Trump was, quote, retaking this territory. Again, retaking it from women playing guitars. McCollum reiterated this point shortly thereafter, saying Trump sent the message that he was taking back this real estate, this territory. Karl Rove, who's advising Trump but doesn't say it when he's on Fox, he pretends that he's independent, insists that Trump's photo op was indicative of him seeking to restore a sense of calm, of peace, of normality to the cities, a message slightly undercut by the use of chemical weapons to get there. And Fox News reporter Kevin Cork referred to the protesters as being ushered out of the park. We've all been to a theater. You've been ushered out of things before, right? I mean, at AMC, they don't often use flashbangs, but they don't rule it out for particular film franchises.
Abraham Lincoln is a weird choice, perhaps because Abraham Lincoln very reluctantly, but in order to give the United States some semblance of justice, presided over the Civil War there, basically, and he was... it tore him up that the country was so divided. But the reason the country was divided was so that justice could be served to black people, and Donald Trump is actively trying to make sure justice is not served to black people. So there's one person who desperately wanted to unite the country in Abraham Lincoln. Again, did not like the war, was not someone who was a warmonger when you look at history. And then Trump himself, who wants to keep it as divisive as possible because that's how he riles up his base.
Yeah. And so finally, we had some politicians. We have Fox News. I guess we can't be too surprised about that. We shouldn't be surprised about this either. I have a feeling, tune in later on today on The Young Turks when Anna Kasparian will almost certainly be raging against this, and justifiably so. Everything that we just described for you, about Donald Trump's speech, how scary and unprecedented and obviously illegal and unconstitutional it was, the ridiculous photo op after, you know, gassing people, including priests, all of that. How does the paper of record describe that night? As chaos spreads, Trump vows to end it now.
I don't get it. I don't get it. He already hates you. Just stop. Like... you're never going to be in Republicans' good graces because they are anti-fact. So maybe just report the facts. It's the most frustrating compulsion.
Yeah.
And I've seen it just talking to people who work in the mainstream media. It's like they're brainwashed in that sense where they have to be what they think is fair, but it's really just this internalized fear of the right that forces them to portray things as they aren't. And just stop it. Just stop. Like, the country's on fire, and stop claiming that it isn't. Stop claiming that Trump's standing there with a hose when he's really standing there with a flamethrower. I almost swore.
You caught it.
So The reason that it's so frustrating for us is, I think you share this view, John, we need these papers that are just going to report straight facts. I mean, we rely on them, you and I do, to analyze the news every day.
Yes.
So in a healthy democracy, there needs to be that kind of objective news outlet that isn't just us, that are, you know, we obviously have a perspective. And so we want them to do better because we need them to do better.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I don't want to. Like, I'm not one of the people who's like, ooh, like, if I attack the New York Times, I can get some people to like me on Twitter or something.
Right.
I don't want to do that. I want them to be good. That's what I want. I don't expect that they're going to be pushing for UBI or anything, but I want them to be reliable. That's what I want. I'm not in this for clout. I'm in this for the country to be where it needs to be. That headline, if they sent that draft to Trump and asked him, any changes, sir? He wouldn't make any. That's what he would have put as the headline, that he's standing astride chaos, vowing to restore peace and justice. But can we really be surprised? I'm sure that if you talk to any individual reporter or person who works at the New York Times, other than Barry Weiss, who's probably horny for fascism. But anyway, if you did that, they'd say, well, I don't want Trump to declare martial law. But you know what else they don't want? They don't want riots because they care about tranquility, the false sense of peace, peace that affects them and the sort of people that they talk to. That's what they want. They're willing to go just so far. But once things start to seem threatened for them, then suddenly, well, you know, Donald Trump does say he's going to end these riots. That almost scares me more than all the rest of it. Marco Rubio and Scott Walker and Fox News and all of them, they're going to line up. And look, even we showed you the MSNBC footage where Garrett Hawk was like, no, this is 100% peaceful. And CNN and MSNBC have done some good stuff during this and some bad stuff. That was good. But the New York Times, whose side are you on? It is very clear. It is front page, first headline clear whose side you're on.
And just one quick point about CNN and MSNBC, like, I do appreciate that they've been really tough on Trump, and that's,
yes,
they deserve credit. But it's so preening, and it's so off-putting to anyone that isn't just purely anti-Trump, which I know a lot of their audience is. They're older people who are horrified by him. I totally get that. I think younger people are horrified by him in a different way, that's less focused on decorum, more focused on fascism and policy. And part of why it's hard for me to watch some of that coverage now that I've been home and watching with my family and stuff is that it's non-existent for corporate Democrats and Republicans. Yeah. So it's hard to watch that and hard for that kind of coverage to have legitimacy when it seems like it's only really there to be feeding the beast of anti-Trump hatred for a certain demographic.
We've now had two relatively conflicting autopsies of George Floyd, with the second most recent one. We're going to give you details on both. But the most recent one from an incredibly credible source asserting that it was, of course, the kneeling on the neck that led to his death. So let's talk about the first and the second. In the first, the medical examiner's preliminary conclusion was that Floyd did not die of, quote, traumatic asphyxia or strangulation after former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin pinned Floyd by the neck with his knee for nearly 9 minutes. Rather, the official report suggested that Floyd's underlying health conditions, including coronary artery disease and hypertensive heart disease, played a role in his death, as well as the fact that Floyd may have been intoxicated. The manner of death was ruled homicide, but the officer noted that, quote, is not a legal determination of culpability or intent. They don't have that capacity. Now, in the second independent autopsy, the new report features a different conclusion, finding that Floyd did die of asphyxiation as Chauvin compressed Floyd's neck and back. The new report was conducted by two forensic pathologists, one of whom, Michael Baden, previously served as chief medical examiner for New York City. And so it is important that they said that it is a direct result of the compression because Minnesota's third-degree murder statute applies to anyone who, quote, causes the death of another by perpetrating an act eminently dangerous to others and evincing a depraved mind without regard for human life. So that word causes is incredibly important. It can't just be a contributing factor. It has to be a determining factor. And the second autopsy is saying that it was obviously the determining factor. It wasn't a coincidence that he happened to die while a guy had his knee on his neck for 9 minutes.
Yeah, that's enormously important, and it's very encouraging that Keith Ellison, who's a strong progressive, is going to be leading this investigation from the outside, as opposed to the friends of Chauvin and the other murder cops involved in this, murderous cops, I should say, but murder cops kind of has a better ring to it. Yeah, exactly. Like RoboCop, except murder. Jesus, sorry. It's just a coping mechanism.
I understand.
Yeah, so That's encouraging, I would say. And it goes, I now trust, because Ellison is going to be leading this investigation and the prosecution, that that information is going to be used to its fullest extent and capacity, as opposed to perhaps being buried or obfuscated by a more corrupt prosecution.
Yeah. We're going to have to see. I mean, having Keith Ellison on it is certainly a step in the right direction, although we'll see how far he's willing to take it. I saw that Sean Hannity called for him to step down because Keith Ellison supports Antifa. So, man, that Antifa thing really just gets you out of everything.
They have no idea what I guess it's Antifa is, right? But Trump keeps going, Antifa, like Ariba. And so then everyone says,
yeah,
like,
I don't care. Whatever. Right?
It's not, there's no organizational structure. It cannot be a group, a terrorist group, because it's not a group in the first place. So many things wrong with this just complete propaganda machine that they're trying to put out there about a group that a group that's not a group that also hasn't killed anybody. And right-wing terrorism is the leading cause of
exactly.
is the leading death causing terrorism in the United States.
Yeah, and we're going to have more on that in just a moment. But I just want to be like, I just want to tell them, you guys, you don't need a new word that you just have to say and it solves all your problems. You already have Obamagate. You just say that, you don't have to define it, and it just solves everything. You're moving on too fast. You got to build a brand. That's what I'm saying.
But honestly, John, though, it's so crazy how effective just saying Antifa over and over again is. I can't tell you how many people who kind of follow the news casually in my life, again, older people watching cable, maybe one specific cable channel, obsessed with Antifa. They don't even know what it means, but it doesn't matter. It just feels right.
They know to be scared.
Right.
And maybe that's enough. There's been a lot of talk about Antifa in the news, and you know, I don't want to just talk baselessly about something I don't understand. So we decided to reach out and find someone affiliated with this organization that is very much an actual organization. So joining us now on the program is media coordinator for Antifa. How's it going?
Oh.
Now I got to show people this tweet from Bill Mitchell, because you had tweeted, she didn't know I was going to do this, everybody.
So I did it.
Emma had tweeted, designating the anti-fascists as terrorists is a pretty clear-cut way to designate yourself as a fascist, which is only the most obvious thing in the world. To which Bill Mitchell, longtime bootlicker of Trump, says, so are you one of the media coordinating with them? Maybe they have a spot in Gitmo for you as well. Hashtag Antifa domestic terrorists.
Yeah, what? You know what, Bill Mitchell? I might use a deadly weapon against you, aka a guitar, just like the protesters at that other. I'm going to sing to you and cause a prison riot. I don't know what I'm talking about.
No, she's mad. That's how they are over at Antifa. And by the way, a lot of confidence in the strength of the branding around that when you have to do hashtag Antifa domestic terrorists.
Right.
If you have to put the domestic terrorists, then I don't think you've really sold it yet. But anyway, look, so I'm sort of joking, but let's be clear about what that is. This guy who just is totally Trump, whatever Trump wants, whatever Trump says, they say Antifa's not actually against fascism, and fascism isn't a real thing, but if it is, it's left wing. I certainly wouldn't support it. Wait, you disagree with me? Maybe you should be in Gitmo, Emma Vigeland. Have you considered that? Maybe there's a place for you. Think about that. How quick they go to independent journalists should be in Gitmo.
I know. Honestly, I'd have a great time with all the other progressive journalists there, to be honest. So we be careful what you wish for. We might lead a prison riot and end Gitmo for good. But not actually. That was a bizarre tweet. So I just retweeted it without comment because he's such a clown that I found it amusing.
And the thing is, like, I don't even really need to ask because I know that you, since you talk about the news online and you're on the left and you're a woman, you probably get death threats literally every day and you have a supernatural ability to shake them off. But does it worry you at all that this, like, very well-known right-winger is implying openly and feels comfortable to do so with Donald Trump, a guy who doesn't care at all about freedom of the press, is just feels comfortable openly saying that you should be locked up and people like you should be locked up?
Does it worry me personally? Probably no, because I'm a little reckless sometimes, but it probably should. I think Donald Trump does embolden these kinds of things. And it goes to show how quickly their mind goes to something like that, where that's how little intellectual or intellectual curiosity they have about why people might be feeling a certain way. If there are some protests that react in a way that they don't like, we just lock you up, because we'd rather people go to prison and be locked away than for us to actually examine our worldview.
Yeah. Okay, let's jump to some other news. I just wanted to throw you under the bus a bit
there. Thank you for that.
There's nothing I was looking forward to more on the show today than bringing that up. I was hoping I could bring it up without you seeing it, and it looks like I was successful in that.
No, you were, and I had a lot of half-baked jokes in response. So okay. I wish if you had told me in advance, I would have prepared better material.
Joe Biden, in response to the protests that have been going on, has been visiting some of the protests and going to black churches to talk to activists and religious leaders. And during that, he has talked a little bit about what he would like to see done in terms of reforms. There is some good stuff coming, especially from a speech this morning in Philadelphia, but some of it I would have probably kept to myself, worked on, and then resubmitted. Take a look at this.
And the idea that instead of standing there and teaching a cop who is an unarmed person of coming at him with a knife or something to shoot him in the leg instead of in the heart is a very different thing. There's a lot of different things that can change.
Okay, so change, he said unarmed. He said unarmed person with a knife. Do we think he meant an armed person and misspoke? It is difficult to tell. Biden struggles with the speaking. So I don't know, man. I don't know.
Yeah, I would say while that would perhaps be more understandable, I would focus on other parts of this process that don't glorify continued violence. I think he probably means, because we've seen people with knives gunned, shot dozens of times and killed. This is not the answer. I think we can just point that out. And look, maybe you're right. And look, I'm not one of the people who thinks I'm going to give the worst faith interpretation of everything Biden says so that people will think I'm cool. I don't do that.
Views, John. Like you need views.
Exactly. I need views. Well, I'm not going to get them, so don't worry about that. And like the people who are like pointing out the, like him saying, I'll beat Joe Biden, when he clearly is saying, I'll be Joe Biden. Like, I'm not interested in that sort of dissection to, anyway. Here, though, that should not have been a part, whether it was the thing I think he said or the thing you think he might have said, none of that should have been a part of this conversation. The aim is not the cop targeting a different part of your body when they pull the trigger. The aim is for cops to stop shooting people. And I think we can get there. And lots of countries are there right now.
But Joe Biden, this is who he is, right? He tries to find the exact middle of the conversation and put that forward as his as his point. So there's one side saying cops need to be basically completely demilitarized and defunded, which is where I'm at. And there's the other side saying, oh, the status quo is totally normal. And he's like, well, what if we could find a perfect middle ground between those two poles? And they would just get shot in the leg as opposed to being killed. There we go. Everyone gets what they want. Happy day. That's Joe Biden in a nutshell.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what he's going to lead as the presumptive Democratic nominee. And if he wins the presidency, which polls indicate he's going to, which, you know, I don't trust all polls, but by God, the country's on fire. So that's how he's going to lead. And certainly it's better than what we've got right now with a fascist wannabe. But it's also problematic, very problematic, and it's part of why we're here in the first place.
100%. And look, it's an area where, look, I've been talking with a lot of different progressive activists, and this is one area where they do think that Biden theoretically could make some good changes and would feel pressure to do so. There had been some efforts at the tail end of the Obama administration in this area, certainly not in all parts of this. I mean, we covered it, but this seems like an area where maybe he'll make some good changes. And I don't have all the details, but he gave a speech earlier today where he called on Congress to pass certain reforms, including outlawing chokeholds, stopping the militarization of police, taking excess weapons of war and vehicles and things like that from abroad and then bringing it back and giving it to the police, better oversight and accountability, which is literally the least anyone could possibly ask for, and certainly not enough. I don't even want it on the list. But commits to creating National Police Oversight Commission in the first 100 days of presidency, maybe that would produce something. So is it what protesters are asking for? Obviously not. Trump is offering overwhelming force and the most ominous weapons the military has. So Biden is going to look to people like a better alternative, certainly.
And unfortunately, many of the gains that the Obama administration put forward were immediately rolled back by Donald Trump. So Obama stopped sending tanks and grenade launchers. Yes, that was a thing to local police departments, a practice where excess military equipment was sent to police departments starting in the 1990s during the war on drugs, which Biden is in many ways partly responsible for. And it ramped up after 9/11, when there was a lot of military equipment as well. So we armed police departments to the teeth. And then Obama in 2015 rolled it back with an executive order. A lot of those weaponry was returned. And then immediately in 2017, mm-hmm. Trump overhauled it. Luckily, we're seeing in Congress a bipartisan effort, at least in the Senate, with Rand Paul making it bipartisan because he agrees with this position. They're trying to make this more permanent in terms of taking back this militarized weaponry from police departments.
Yes.
But there's a very good chance that Trump would veto it. Joe Biden probably would not veto this. So there's a good indicator of the difference there.
Yeah, and look, in this area and in others, the thing that can be easily reversed by the new Trump administration can be de-versed by the next administration. And, you know, I automatically think about the dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of environmental regulations that were put into effect under Obama and reversed under Trump. But there are some in this area as well that hypothetically could be quickly reversed, even if the Senate doesn't go Democrat at the end of the year. Continue.
No, my point was just that, yeah, I mean, we're in this age of hyper partisanship that I think oftentimes is it's overstated because Republicans and Democrats do agree on a lot of things, but mostly it's from the Republican side where they vetoed everything that Obama put forward. And it makes it very hard for permanent legislation to pass in this area. So that's why it was able to be undone so easily by Trump, because executive orders are flimsy. And that was the reality of the situation when Republicans controlled the House and the Senate, when Obama tried to make those reforms.
I know that there's a lot of people out there that are really worried about the looting that's been going on in America. And so I thought, you know what, we're gonna do some serious coverage of this looting and the toll that it has taken. And This information is coming from an Inspector General report that says that the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration for the IRS found that nearly 1 million high-income individuals who didn't file returns cumulatively failed to pay over $45 billion in taxes between 2014 and 2016, and that the agency hasn't tried to collect from many of those taxpayers. So I don't know exactly what that equals out to in terms of like watches or shoes or TVs or whatever, but $45 billion has been looted from the US government by extremely wealthy people protected by layers of lawyers, and the IRS, either because of a lack of interest or a lack of resources or both, has decided we're not even going to try to get that money back. That is some high quality looting right there.
Well, it doesn't count as looting if wealthy people do it, because they do it in secrecy and they're very sophisticated when they do it, and they're doing it motivated by greed. When you're poor, when you're black, when you're protesting inequality and you're motivated by anger towards the injustices that you face your entire life or your friends have, no, that counts as looting. So I would say that perhaps the millionaires and billionaires should get away with it, because as long as it's a number on a screen, people don't really care, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. If it's a product, I mean, then it's property. It's serious. If it's money that should have been available to the US government to pay for, you know, food stamps, infrastructure, God only knows what, maybe we could have afforded some of the PPE and things like that. Maybe we could have fast tracked those tests if we'd had that money. That's too hard. Let's not think about that.
Wasn't that supposed to trickle down on us? Wasn't it supposed to? I mean, right?
Theoretically, it trickled $45 billion less than it seemed like it should have. So here is how bad it actually was. So we talked about the raw numbers. The IRS didn't put 326,000 of the cases into its enforcement system, and it closed 42,000 of the cases without ever working on them. Hundreds of thousands of cases of huge quantities of money that are owed to the federal government didn't even get logged into the system. And tens of thousands, they were like, I just don't feel like it. We're done with that. You think they'd do that with you if you shoplifted some cereal or something? No, that's what they did. And I understand that some are going to say, you know, it's because, you know, there's huge budget cuts, 19% decline in collection staff. And that is certainly why mostly Republicans, not entirely, but mostly Republicans have been pushing for further and further cuts to the IRS in the last decade or two. But this is the result. You get to get away with cheating the government out of tax revenue. And that's when there actually are taxes. They've been cutting them and cutting them and cutting them. But even then, what remains, they don't necessarily pay.
Exactly. So we have corporate looting where Amazon doesn't pay any taxes whatsoever. And then you have rich person looting. But none of this gets attention from mainstream press because the images of poor or black people or protesters taking a TV out of a Target, that's going to scare people. That drives fear. And if it bleeds, it leads. And then, wow, your ratings are up. But when it comes to the actual millionaire, billionaire corporate overlords who are actually affecting your day-to-day, that's not as compelling and might actually offend our parent companies or our bosses.
While much of the talk around reopening the economy has focused on the economy portion of it, people getting back to work and businesses revving back up, a significant portion of the conversation has been focused around what is going on with kids and schooling. And for the many parents around the country that have been suddenly cast as homeschoolers, this is a big concern for there. So joining us now to talk about the future of schooling during this pandemic, where we go from here, we've got Mark Porter McGee, founder and CEO of 50 Can and senior fellow at Georgetown University's Future Ed. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John, for having me.
Glad to have you here. And, you know, I wanted to start off by giving you an opportunity to tell us about the organization and the work that you're currently doing right now.
Thank you. So so I play two roles. So one role is I'm the founder and CEO of 50 Can, which is short for the 50 State Campaign for Achievement Now. And the basic idea is we want to make it easier for concerned parents and students and citizens to be advocates for a great education for all kids. Mm-hmm. And we think, you know, there's a role for every form of government to play, but 90% of the funding for schools is local. 90% of the big decisions that get made happen at the state or district level. So that's what we're all about, is helping people advocate in their own backyard.
So catch us up a little bit. So obviously this has been a pretty disruptive couple of months. How disruptive has it been in the short term and from your view in the long term in kids, in terms of kids' education?
So, you know, I think we use the word unprecedented a lot in the past few months, but it really is unprecedented in American education to have 90, 95% of kids being educated in their own home. We haven't seen that in 150 years since the advent of the first public schools. So we're in completely uncharted territory. We went from, you know, 5% of kids being homeschooled to 90, 95%. And we did it without any planning. It just all kind of happened. You know, kids were in school on a Friday. They were not in school on a Monday. There was very little training, very little equipment set up ahead of time. So it's hard to overstate how chaotic it's been.
And I guess maybe a silver lining is, I know I've seen a little bit of anecdotal evidence that some parents have enjoyed the process of becoming more invested in their kids' education. From your point of view, is it likely that that's probably pretty rare in comparison to parents being overwhelmed and kids potentially being set back quite a bit in their education?
Yeah, I think that's right. Now, it's probably, you know, for most people, not a complete black and white situation. So I think there's a lot of frustrations when we talk to parents and your internet isn't working or you don't have the equipment or your kids miss their classmates or their teacher. That can be really hard. Obviously, if you're juggling work where you either need to leave your apartment, which is challenging for what to do with kids, or you need to work at home, that can be hard to juggle. So it's very much an emergency situation. But we know that some kids have really connected in a different way with this work. Parents are obviously having to be brought into their kids' education in a different way. So they're getting a better understanding of how to help their kids. So there's a little bit of a silver lining, but it's definitely a mixed bag.
And you talked about a lot of this policy is set locally. Locally, have you seen much of much being done to try to catch kids up? Do you have advice on some of the things parents could be advocating for in localities around the country to try to fill this gap that's been created so unexpectedly?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, a lot of our advocates very early on were engaged with sort of a hierarchy of needs. So we know a lot of kids get their meals at school. So there was a lot of innovative work done to figure out how to get meals to kids. So there were people set up sites around cities to pick up meals. Districts reuse school buses to bring those meals around. And then lately we've been seeing an innovative approach where we're getting money directly in the hands of parents electronically so they can purchase those meals. So that's been a big push around connectivity, free internet, free devices. You might say that's kind of part of the new package of public education is your kids deserve to have that connectivity. And then the real challenge has been instruction. So some of the more innovative districts and schools are figuring out a way to provide a whole continuum of learning. So kids can log on and get real-time instruction, live instruction. They're also recording those videos so you can watch them offline. And then there's a whole lot of interactivity in different apps and websites. So that's sort of the continuum. But I think most of us who've looked at this are concluding that right now kids are on average learning less than they would have if they were in school.
If we were to turn to nationally, what would you say about what's been done by the federal government so far to try to fill that gap? Is that likely to be enough to fill the gap that you're seeing? Is there some you know, different path that you'd like to see future aid legislation take in this area?
So I think the first thing we need to decide is, how do we rate the essentialness of schooling? So we would commit that schooling is one of the most important things we need to have working right. So if we don't have school working right, we're not only falling behind as a country in learning, but it's incredibly disruptive to families. So far, we've dedicated about $13 billion in federal aid to our K-12 system, which sounds like a lot of money until you realize we spend about $600 billion a year. So it's really just a fraction. Wow. And what we're asking of our schools is so much more. So it's actually much more expensive to transition to online learning, to have that equipment in place. And what we're thinking about in the fall is a whole variety of things that need to change. So one of the ideas is that you'd have half as many kids in a classroom. So that means that you need twice as much space. So this is going to be really challenging, and we really do need extra money for schools right now.
Yeah, and potentially twice as many professors, which is certainly good news for kids finishing up their dissertations and thinking about going into academia. But I want to talk a little bit about, you talked about the $13 billion, and that money is obviously seems wholly inadequate as a lump sum, but apparently it's also localities are having trouble figuring out exactly how they should spend it. I know that the Secretary of Education has been saying she wants the majority to go towards private schools, even though in a lot of these areas it's overwhelmingly public. Is that going to create significant barriers to even the small amount of aid that's been provided actually getting to kids?
There does seem to be a lot of chaos right now and a lot of confusion about how to get this money into hands of schools quickly. The way the federal law was written is it said it should be a formula based on the number of low-income kids in schools. The secretary then gave guidance that seemed to suggest that additional money would go to private schools. Now you have states like Mississippi saying, well, we're going to follow the letter of the law. So it's really confusing right now. And you know, I think probably no cabinet leader right now in the Trump administration has a lot of credibility, but particularly Secretary DeVos is really doesn't have a lot of credibility within the education community right now. So that's also compounding it.
And a sort of related issue that potentially could tie into the economic struggles that people are experiencing and that certainly will follow in the wake of once we finally move past this pandemic is there was going to be legislation that was going to overturn Betsy DeVos's intervention on student loan forgiveness that has been itself taken out. What do you think about that as a potential avenue for effort to try to get some aid for those, you know, already overburdened by a ton of student loan debt? Presumably that itself would be vetoed as well, but is this an area that you think some good could be done in?
Well, I think, you know, we really have two crises in education right now. We have the crises of not being able to get into school buildings and all the compounding complexity and cost with that. And we had the crisis before that of student loans, where there were so many people burdened with their effort to go and do what we asked them to do, which is go get a higher education. So I think anything we can do on the higher education loans that helps people right now is what we should be doing, because no one can afford even their daily expenses, let alone these huge student loans.
Yeah. You know, and I'm curious. I know that right now we're trying to deal with a pandemic, which is still claiming hundreds and hundreds of American lives every day. But it seems like for the kids, they're potentially being set back. Some might miss a semester or longer because we don't know. There's talk about the possibility of a second wave coming as kids would be going off to you know, high school and college and all of that. If they are forced to miss a semester or two, then that also means that, you know, their graduation is being set back, their careers are being set back. Is there an understanding or awareness of the fact that this is going to have ripple effects spreading decades into the future, potentially?
I think we know that academically. So there's been a lot of research that's looked in America and in other countries at what happens when kids miss school. So there was a study in Argentina where there was big rolling strikes and some kids in the country missed a few months of school. And you could actually track the cost of that over the course of their career. So they actually earned less money over the course of their career. And even more daunting is that you could actually see an impact on those kids' kids. So it actually ripped down a generation. So it's troubling and really scary. I would say that the challenge is where everyone's working really hard against the odds. And so I think that a little bit of just resignation is set in, like, this is what we have to deal with.
Yeah. So huge struggles ahead. And I know, for parents who are currently dealing with it, your organization has resources, collections of places where people can get help and things like that. Can you tell people where they can find that?
Absolutely. So you can go to our website, which is 50can.org. So it's 50can.org. We've got a whole section on COVID-19 with resources for parents. We have active campaigns with people on the ground you can plug into. We also do a weekly news roundup where we bring all of the resources and actions and all the things that are happening at the federal and state level right into your inbox. So you can sign up for that.
Awesome. Mark Porter McGee, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.